This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Friday, September 6th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. This week, the Prime Minister and the House of Commons engaged in one of the most vicious political battles in British history. The revolt began after Boris Johnson, who has been in office for only 6 weeks, received the Queen's approval to suspend Parliament between September 11th and October 14th. That gave MPs virtually no time to pass legislation that could stop the United Kingdom from leaving the European Union without a deal on October 31st. 21 members of Johnson's Conservative Party, dubbed the Rebel Alliance, were prominently among those who fought back. They passed a bill that would block a no-deal exit from the EU and denied Johnson's call for a general election. Johnson banned them all from the party and threatened to call an election in October. And that was only the start. On Thursday, at a press conference at a police training center in Yorkshire, Johnson answered questions about Brexit.
Can you make a promise today to the British public that you will not go back to Brussels and ask for another delay to Brexit?
Yes.
And
sorry. I can.
And would you
I'd rather be dead in a ditch.
So you would resign first, Prime Minister, rather than go and ask for that delay?
It costs £1 billion a month. It achieves absolutely nothing. What on earth is the point of a further delay?
Sam Knight, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me from London to discuss Johnson's rise to power and what this week's dramas signal about the future of Brexit and the potential damage to British democracy. Sam, welcome back.
Hello, hello. Very nice to be back.
You've had quite a week.
Yeah. very much so.
So we spoke last in March when Theresa May was still Prime Minister and she was experiencing her own parliamentary humiliations over Brexit. She stepped down in June. Boris Johnson could not be more different. She was known for her very sober, kind of grinding Brexit strategy. Johnson is convinced that the British public is sick of this seemingly endless departure process, and I'm sure he's right about that. But he prides himself on his opportunistic kind of come-what-may approach to politics. Tell us a little bit about his journey from journalism to 10 Downing Street.
Yes, well, you're completely right. You know, Johnson and Theresa May couldn't be more different as political creatures. You know, Johnson is more like a celebrity. You know, Johnson was a famous person in the UK since the late 90s, firstly as a journalist for the Daily Telegraph.
Based in Brussels.
Yes, you know, and I think, you know, within sort of political circles, he's known really since his mid-20s when he was really responsible for, if you like, creating a new genre of British journalism, which started to see the European Union as something almost hilarious, this kind of overreaching bureaucratic monster that wanted to sort of get rid of bendy bananas and create uniform condom sizes and all sorts of things. Johnson, who has a kind of a taste for the absurd and for humor, sort of started, you know, an extremely successful career on the right of British political commentary. And so his gifts are for, you know, some of this will sound familiar, saying unsayable things, coming up with something on the spur of the moment, grabbing all the attention successfully. But also, you know, we shouldn't kind of underestimate Johnson. He has a feel-good factor. Most people around the world probably know the image of Johnson sagging on a zip wire during the 2012 Olympic Games in London when he was the mayor of London. You know, which other politician could turn that to their advantage? And yet everyone sort of laughs and says, there goes Boris.
Along with his gaffes and his lies and the rest of it.
Yeah. And, you know, I think things are changing, you know, quite fast at the moment. But that's certainly the figure that arrived in Downing Street this summer. And a completely different character to Theresa May, but inheriting exactly the same political situation and political challenge.
So you wrote yesterday for TheNewYorker.com about the good chap theory of British government, which I loved. I'd never heard of that before. What is that? And is it now gone forever?
The good chap theory of government was coined by a very, you know, distinguished British historian called Peter Hennessy, and it describes the way that the British Constitution works. And the British Constitution is always a kind of tricky phrase. The truth is that Britain has a constitution that's written down in literally thousands of different places in terms of parliamentary procedure, in terms of court cases. It's this kind of palimpsest of processes that have kind of gone into the way that Britain has been sort of more or less democratically governed for the last 500 or 600 years. And the good chap theory of government is that people observe tradition, they stay within precedent. I think probably the kind of the best single example of this is the idea of commanding the confidence of the House of Commons. When you've lost the confidence, the ability to function and exert authority, you are supposed to resign. And that really is down to people in moments of extreme crisis and tension sort of knowing that the game is up.
And Theresa May did know when the game was up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this isn't black and white. Nothing's kind of black and white in this process. And Theresa May certainly took advantage of certain situations according to parliamentary procedure. But nonetheless, in her showdowns with Parliament, she basically played a straight bat.
Yeah, and that is not Johnson's way at all. So give us a sense of the mad scene this week in Parliament. You know, over here, we're so accustomed to cravenly compliant Republicans in the House and the Senate. So it was just astonishing to see the audacity of the Rebel Alliance in action.
Yeah. So I think I'll take a step back and sort of say, you know, what was Johnson trying to achieve this week and sort of how did it go so wrong?
Yes.
So his sort of goal is to try and get Britain out of the EU on October the 31st. And the play that he comes up with is to suspend Parliament and shut down both houses entirely for this critical period when MPs could be passing motions or passing laws and trying to sort of get in his way. Johnson misjudged several things here. He misjudged how furious the House of Commons would be. He misjudged how organized they would be. And he misjudged, the, as you describe it, you know, the audacity of really long-serving, mainstream, in many cases fairly unremarkable, absolutely loyal conservative MPs to go against him.
Including Nicholas Soames, Churchill's 71-year-old grandson. Churchill, I gather, is a great hero figure to Johnson.
I mean, it's remarkable. Nicholas Soames, a former defense secretary, grandson of Winston Churchill, he goes door to door in his constituency during elections on horseback. He's almost a caricature. He sort of embodies this kind of one nation moderate conservatism. He'd rebelled against the government three times in 37 years, and once was enough for the Johnson administration to throw him out of the party. And I think, you know, to sort of add to these miscalculations, I think Johnson miscalculated the public sympathy that would be on the side of some of these longstanding MPs.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Okay, now you have to explain something else to me, which is sort of, we're still not at the end of this process. Mm. So as I understand it, Johnson's plan to call a general election was temporarily stymied by that parliamentary vote. But how does it look now? It sounds as though a new election is still likely.
So the rebellion that took place this week was that the Rebel Alliance, which is this coalition of Labour and the Scottish Nationalists and the Liberal Democrats, plus this group of conservative backbenchers, passed a law. Then the law says that if Johnson is really trying to leave with no deal by October the 19th, then he has to put that to a vote in the House of Commons. The expectation is that he would lose that vote, and then this law obliges him to go to the European Union and ask for another extension to the Brexit process. So they came up with a sort of a technical way to bind his hands, which is extraordinary in the context of British politics. You know, the Prime Minister leads the legislative agenda in this country. You don't have opposition groups making laws. It simply doesn't happen. That is a freakish occurrence. And that bound Johnson's hands. He's furious. He says, okay, I need a general election. In order to call a snap general election in this country, you currently need two-thirds of the votes in the House of Commons. Johnson clearly doesn't have that. Labour and the Rebel Alliance, in inverted commas, were unwilling to give that to him until that law is on the statute books. So we'll probably see a date for an election fixed next week. But there'll be a big fight about it because Johnson wants to have the election before the Brexit date of October the 31st to give him a free hand in the negotiations. And his opponents, who now are clearly feeling a measure of power after the events of this week, want to make him stew and probably want to force him to ask for that delay, which would be very humiliating for Johnson, and then have an election.
Johnson is casting this scorched earth campaign in populist terms. And I gather that he thinks by calling a general election, he can pitch it as people versus parliament. Will that work?
Well, I think this could still very well play into his hands in exactly the way that you describe, of someone trying to deliver Brexit, trying to do something that the country voted for. And who's he being stopped by? He's being stopped by a group of never say die Remainers who most of the public don't know their names. They don't understand the arcane procedures that are taking place, the kind of centuries of precedent which might be being observed or thrown out of the window, depending, you know, which way you look at it. And it will be easy for Johnson to characterize himself as a sort of a bluff on your side guy trying to deliver Brexit, being held back by the metropolitan elites in London who can't let the European Union go. And, you know, that's an argument that he will make, and he might well be successful with it.
So Labour and the other political parties will see this coming. How are they positioning themselves?
It's going to be very, very messy. And I think that's the judgment that they have to make at the moment. If they really make Johnson sweat, if they really hold off granting him an election, it only strengthens his argument that they are stymieing progress, stymieing a sense of resolution, stymieing, you know, us getting out of this horrible Brexit impasse. And to a certain extent, he will be right about that. You know, Labour's weakness since the referendum, really, has been the inability to put forward a simple Brexit policy. Everyone knows what the Conservatives stand for. Everyone knows even more what they stand for under Johnson. Labour, are they trying to do a managed, gentle, agreed departure with the European Union? Do they want to hold a second referendum? Do they want to revoke Brexit entirely? They are split on those questions, and the public generally don't know what they stand for because the position shifts with each week, and that will be exposed during an election campaign.
What a disaster. So is a general election the only way to solve the deadlock?
Well, in terms of the way that British politics generally works, yes, it is. When Parliament is stuck, when the Prime Minister can't get their agenda through, the British Constitution, that mysterious thing, demands a general election. And so it's the natural fix. You know, hovering in the background is this question of a second referendum, as is that some people see that as the only way to sort of put the genie back in the bottle, or absolutely, you know, seal the deal as far as Brexit But you only get to a second referendum once you've had a general election and there's a majority in the House of Commons for it.
How damaging do you think this week has been? Is this inflicted long-term problems on British democracy?
I think it has, or I think it's certainly changed British democracy. I had a fascinating discussion this week with a constitutional expert called Catherine Haddon at the Institute of Government, who sort of keep a very close eye on these things. And I used the same word. I said, oh, is this damaging British democracy? And she hesitated to use the word damage. She said, look, this is changing it. The British Constitution is this ancient, musty thing, and each generation and each great moment of rupture in politics updates it. That's the way it goes. But these are certainly extraordinary times in which new precedents are being set. And I'm not sort of exaggerating by saying that, you know, this week we probably saw half a dozen of those things. You know, to take one example, this piece of legislation to stop Johnson leaving without a deal, which most people, certainly on the anti-Brexit side of the argument, but even people who accept Brexit but think that we definitely should have a deal. So really, people trying to take a fairly centrist view on this question, people cheered that. They thought that was a moment of common sense. In terms of how that bill was enacted, that will create great problems for other governments in the future. You know, the rebel alliances, we're calling them, took advantage of a piece of procedure which literally enables them to have a debate in the House of Commons. But they didn't just have a debate, they stuck a law into it. And the next time, you know, let's say Labour or a coalition of anti-Brexit parties win the coming election, you know, you can sort of bet your bottom dollar that Johnson or the Conservatives will try and pull the same move on them. You know, so we are setting strange precedents in this moment.
Thank you so much, Sam. To be continued, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
Sam Knight is a staff writer at The New Yorker, based in London. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.